I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 193 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. I have known and enjoyed this week's guest, Robbie Foulkes, for decades, both musically and personally. Chicago's Bloodshot Records released his debut album, Country Love Songs, back in 1996.
She liked everything about me except for one thing. She liked every kind of music but country.
His major label leap came 2 years later with the harder rocking Let's Kill Saturday Night.
I've got a little red bullet. Let's kill Saturday night.
Here we are in 2025 with Robbie at age 62, still on the rise. His awesome guitar picking skills and singing drew the attention of Steve Martin, who added him to his bluegrass band with banjo extraordinaire Allison Brown. Robbie recently played with them at the Hollywood Bowl and on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and has been on the Steve Martin, Martin Short, The Dukes of Funnytown tour. In fact, I saw them perform in Appleton, Wisconsin last weekend, and Robbie and the band sounded great. Steve Martin and Martin Short are awfully funny, too. Robbie has a new album, Now Then, that came out September 5th on Compass Records. Robbie says he thinks it's his best. When you listen to it, it's tough to argue with him, even as he had set the bar high with a progression from Gone Away Backward to the Grammy-nominated Upland Stories.
And in the instant I knew I would not forget the sight, Alabama at night, Alabama at night.
To 2023's Bluegrass Vacation. The new album begins with a spoken word statement.
It's time to make a change.
Musically, Robbie is covering a ton of stylistic ground. Folk, country, bluegrass, and a fierce rocker, now, powered by the drumming of Pete Thomas of Elvis Costello and the Attractions.
In your head, I'll allow.
Lyrically, Robbie is digging deeper than ever into his memories and the impact of the past upon the present.
I'm in love with my whole family. We're all funny and we're all strange. We went down to Ocean City. Maybe we'll come back changed.
He also reflects on the 30-year marriage.
What's a 30-year marriage? So poor a cup. Good years still ahead and money enough. Now the hard days of children and jealous mistrust were over.
And stings the funny bone with poor and sharp-witted.
Poor and sharp-witted, beats loaded and dumb. Living in the world, why did you ride up by getting out of where you're from?
The sharp-witted Robbie is a freewheeling conversationalist, so this conversation covers a lot of ground. It includes how his move from Chicago to Los Angeles has affected his life and career, even as he's self-conscious about how it all might sound to everyone back in Chicago. He tells of how he got connected to Steve Martin and what happened the first time he went to Martin's house. He also gets into how he approaches music nowadays, whether he's talking about his own songs or Bob Dylan covers, and why he continues to hit artistic and creative peaks in his early 60s. Has he become an overnight sensation at last? Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Robbie Foulkes. Well, congratulations. You got a new album coming out.
I was
reading some of your back, interviews and material, and from like 2013 when Gone Away Backward was coming out, you were saying as far as the backwardness of the record, I think it goes backward in terms of nostalgia for the past, bittersweet nostalgia for the past, as well as the recession having knocked everything backwards for people. In that sense, it's not an album about the past. It's an album about now. And now your new album is Now Then. It seems like you're constantly kind of wrestling with this stuff that's happened and how you move forward with it. Like that's become like one of your themes. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I guess so. I think, you're in a better position to analyze it than me probably, but those two records that you just referenced, the one, I think the earlier one is more about society maybe in America, and this newer one is more about me, I think, but they're both, They're both, yes, tinged with backward looking and regret and ruefulness and a little comedy and, you know, the usual things that I traffic in.
Is it sort of a, you know, time of your life kind of thing too, where you're sort of at that phase where you're trying to process, well, how did I get here? And then what?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I've been in that phase ever since I was probably 48 or something like that. I'm 62 now. But yeah, I often think you look back at the past and like there are stories that I tell before I do songs that are pretty like when I perform that are pretty like, you know, dug in. And I, you know, tend to tell them the same way all the time. But there's one story, and this is a pretty tangential way to answer your question. There's a story that I tell before my song 70s Jesus, which is about the real thing that happened to me when I was a kid. And we went to the Unitarian Church, and then my mom kind of got a crush on the minister, and then we went to live on his commune for a little bit, and blah, blah, blah. In my view, like an amplified, exaggerated, slightly, you know, elaborate story of a real life thing. But then I was at a show near there. I was doing a show near there a year and a half ago, where a lady in the audience came up, and she's like 90, and she was there at the church where this guy spoke that my mom had a crush on, and she started telling me about the particulars of it, like what his name was and when he died and what his commune was like and all this stuff, what his wife was like. And I was like, holy shit. So all this really happened. And like in my mind, it's like, it's just a story that I tell. I'm not even sure that any of this actually happened anymore. It's just words in a story. So that's a slipperiness that happens with age, I think, is that these things solidify in your mind and they kind of detach from reality in a way. You're not sure if the connection is that strong.
Right. Well, and you give shape to them, which, you know, sometimes the shape is a song or just even the way you recall it in your mind. There's kind of this arc and sort of you sort of file it away in terms of like how it was significant in your life, as opposed to when you were going through it, you don't think, oh, I'm in the middle of this arc right now. You know, I'm in the middle of the story arc and we'll see how it ends. And, you know, so that's part of looking back and telling stories, right, is giving shape to the stuff that happened.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of stuff is just closed. It's just, you know, closed off. Like, that's over. That was a phase, and now that's ended. And I'm sure that's a false, you know, narratively convenient way to look at your life. A lot of stuff's still there, but yeah, that we impose the story logic, I guess, upon our actual experience, which is a little bit false, but helpful in some way.
How old were you when you were in this commune, and how long were you there?
We were there, well, again, going by my memory, 24 hours, like one night. And then my dad had an argument with a guy and we vamoosed real quick. So that's the way my telling goes. If my mom hears this, she'll have a totally different take and maybe even deny that any of this ever happened. But
the whole part about the minister and the crush and stuff.
Yeah, in my mind, he looked exactly like Don McLean. But I think that's all confused with the fact that American Pie was popular and we had the record and, you know, all this stuff's getting mixed up in my mind. But I definitely remember the place that we went. I definitely remember my dad's argument. I mean, there's stuff about this that's definitely true.
I love the in this new song, Ocean City, you have a reference to Then Came You. You don't explain it, but, you know, Then Came You is a fantastic Spinners Dionne Warwick song. Is that a song that you actually heard in Ocean City that you dropped in there because you had that memory? Or was that a detail you just thought was cool to include?
You know, that was added because... And I think this is not uncommon in songwriting, you know, and this is what turns it into more of a work of imagination just naturally, which is that you have this real life outline and, okay, I'm just going to be bold enough to write a song about my family at Ocean City, which is the most, you know, banal, trivial kind of personal thing to write about in a way. But then you have these things to fill in, these details to fill in. And like in one case, I wanted to talk about my uncle in a verse, and somehow the word uncle didn't work and cousin did. And there was a need for like a younger character. And so I falsified it. So I changed my uncle to a cousin who's a kid my age. And then, oh, I want to use a song title, something I heard on the radio. And what does the line look like? Well, the line wants like maybe not a lot of syllables, like three would be perfect.
Right.
Different song titles. I think I probably looked at, you know, 1974 hits and made sure to use one that I actually knew and felt, you know, positively about. But a lot of it was just like fitting in the line and how the words sound.
Right. Like Come On, Feel the Noise was not going to work there nostalgically or for the meter.
Yeah, Slade never really played for me anyway.
And he probably wouldn't have been hearing Slade at Ocean City at that time. But so that's something where you're, you know, in your adulthood sort of looking back on things to write about, and you're just like, oh, that Ocean City trip, that sort of stuck with me in this way. I'm going to sort of explore it as a songwriter and then find a story in there, even though, you know, it's a song, so it's not a documentary and I'm going to change some stuff. But like at some point, like what's the click that you think, okay, I want to write a song about that now?
I don't really know what that click is. I mean, it's, and it never kind of is a click. Because, I mean, I feel like I've described my process boringly other times, but I go off and get alone. In the case of this record, I spent a lot of time in the desert and in a house by myself in the desert in Yucca Valley. And I just write, I just spill out chords and cadences and title ideas and hum and just whatever comes out, comes out. And at some point, that scene, I guess, of Ocean City kind of came out, or a little bit of the melody, and just kind of work at it from there. And there's no click because you're going on instinct of what feels like it's promising, right, and hopeful. And, you know, you've written a lot of songs, too, and I think you probably would agree that when you're a quarter of the way in, halfway in, you know, you're thinking, well, maybe this is okay, and it's right, okay enough to go forward with. But a lot of times you'll get all the way to the end, and sometimes it'll even be a year later after you performed at places, or the worst case, even made a record of it, and like realize much later, yeah, I don't think so.
So you have songs of yours that you look back on and you're like, nah, that didn't work. That song shouldn't exist.
Most of my songs don't work. I mean, yeah.
That's not true.
Well, no, most, like, I don't know, 5-6 of them, a big fraction of them go in the garbage and don't get heard. And then, the ones that are on the record, yeah, some of them I really don't like. Not most of them, but.
Yeah, I hope. No, most of them are really good. That's why you're where you are. You know, that's why you
five of them are really good. Most of them aren't that good.
Has your batting average improved over the years, you think? Because a lot of people, they get older and they get worse, but I don't think you do. I think you get better every time.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, like, trajectory. Most people do get worse. I mean, most people, I don't know, what do you think? The first album or two is good, and then it's like, I don't know what's going on anymore.
It's almost like there are these two different paths, because there are the people like someone like Richard Thompson, who's been doing this since he was, you know, in the late 60s, mid 60s, 67, is that mid or late? And every time he puts out something, you're like, yeah, that's a Richard Thompson album. There's not like, I'm a little sad for the guy. You know, like, I've never had that feeling. You know, Steve Dawson, every time it comes out, you're like, yeah, that's a great Steve Dawson record. And you are in that category as well. And I don't know whether it's
still
a sort
evolving,
of
evolving, right? And I think I am too. We're both still evolving and trying new things. And I often think that, like, one of the, I mean, this sounds ironic or facetious, but one of the nice things about not having been very, very successful in my career is that I don't have any pressure to, you know, get in that groove and repeat the sound of the last record or whatever. And that's been great, you know, because for me, like, half of the point of the thing is to try different things out. And like, my hero when I was young, when I was a kid, was Bob Dylan. And of course, like, all through the 70s, when I was a kid and listening to Bob Dylan, like, he'd put out a record and like, what the hell's the next one going to be? You know, what's he doing now? He's changed his mask. And that model always stuck in my mind as a just a way to be interesting and a way to develop your talents and a way just to, yeah, to stay interested in the game of music.
And you fell for Street Legal. Like you were like, Street Legal is one of the great Dylan records.
Right.
Because he's doing something different and the songs are great. And it's also like not, I mean, you have your reasons for covering, you know, the album Street Legal, but it's one of these albums where if someone's just sort of measuring like the hits or the importance or whatever, you're like, well, Street Legal's sort of in there somewhere. But it's like, hey, he kept doing what he was doing, and you know, doing Street Legal or whatever album you're doing enables you to do the next thing with a fresh, you know, slate.
Street Legal is interesting, and this is true of some of his many of his other records too. I think it's like Guy Maddin was saying about early filmmaking, that, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, the technological developments were coming so fast and furious that no single development was ever exactly pursued to fruition. And that's why he feels emboldened, I guess you might say, to like try some of these older techniques, you know, like the technique where there's a narrator in the theater explaining what's happening
right. As
things happen. I thought that was an interesting insight, and it reminded me of this thing about Bob Dylan records where, like, what invited me or emboldened me into, like, remaking that album Street Legal, I think, was that it was they're incomplete thoughts, you know, in the execution of it. Like, there was a thought of, you know, the band's going to be like this. The lyrics and the chords are this, but there's a lot that's slapdash about it, right? I mean, in the opening lines, you hear the I think it's the three or four background singers. I think they're reading the lyrics off of file cards that he just wrote out, and they're not quite sure what the phrasing is on the lines that they're singing, and maybe they can't even quite make out the words that he's handwritten on that.
Huh.
So there's this uncertainty in it, and to me, that like incompleteness invites you in to like take your own stab at these songs in a way that it wouldn't if it were like Britney Spears music or something that's just fully, you know, it's there and it's
right. Gone. Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, and I mean, Dylan in general is fascinating because he's like so the opposite of precious about his music and his catalog, and that he'll come out and sometimes you'll be like, wait, what is he doing to that song? What's going on? Whereas, you know, someone like McCartney, and you know that I'm a big, you know, Beatles McCartney nut, but it drives me a little crazy that, you know, McCartney, after slagging what Phil Spector did to The Long and Winding Road, will have his keyboardist play the string part on his synthesizer that he hated. Like, why do we need to hear that part of, why can't you do the Let It Be Naked version of Long and Winding Road at the very least, or just mess with it, you know, just kind of go, you could go in and mess, your songs are sturdy enough to mess with them. And Dylan always knew his stuff was sturdy enough to mess with. You, because you never got locked into people needing to hear something the exact same way every time, you could go out with, I mean, what have you, I don't know if you've counted, but you've probably been out with about 562 different combinations of musicians to play with. I mean, you're always playing with different people, so it's never kind of fixed in like amber or anything.
Yeah, that's right. And that's interesting. The Beatles way is probably by now the much more common way, right? Like, the document is the record, and once it's out there, that's the reference point that everybody, you know, the players and the author and the audience all have in mind. And so to divagate from that is like laborious, right? It like takes, it's kind of costly, you know, it takes work. And in the end, it's maybe not what anybody in the audience even wants to hear. They want something that like touches that point in their brain where they fell in love with the record. But I think that's all rational. But I think Dylan's way of going about it is attractive because it's a little more folkloric, right? It's like more when Ma Rainey or somebody like that would make a record, like the record would be something that you'd like do one day. It wouldn't define the song or the life of the performance of the song, either, you know, the way they'd been performing it before or after, I don't think, you know. It was another little piece in the life of the song. It wasn't this big tree whose shade fell over the whole deal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are whole genres that are built on that. I mean, I've been listening a little more to jazz over the last several years, just trying to find new things to explore and finding it really interesting. And you read the reviews, and it's all this 1958 session, they were doing this for 6 hours, and this is, and they, you know, and then they'll do the same song 3 years later, and it's all about kind of what was happening in the room at that moment, as opposed to, you know, here's the, you know, Herbie Hancock did Watermelon Man, but then he did it again, and it was on another classic album, and, you know, there wasn't like, wait a minute, you have to play the 1960 version or whatever it was.
Well, I'm glad you said that. That's the perfect illustration of that, and that shows that when you don't have lyrics going on, it does lead naturally into that direction. And of course, the whole genre is based on honoring the improvisational instincts of the players. And once you have lyrics, like, you don't feel free to change the lyrics every time that you sing it. So the lyrics are commanding you to obey a structure. And I guess in some way that I really haven't thought through, you know, the given melody of the lyrics is also exerting a strong pressure. You know, you're not free to John Coltrane up the melody of Yesterday by Paul McCartney when you sing it and just change right. It all around.
Well, and it seems like folk tradition is more, it's more about evolving as opposed to sort of fixing it in a certain, you know, all right, now you have to sing this like they did in 58 or something like that, I would think. I don't know. People were constantly covering each other's songs and interpreting them in different ways.
Right. There's that. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of pieces to it. And there's also intellectual property, which I think affects this somehow. But.
Yeah. So for you, you've had all these years of being productive, and you've always had these champions like, oh, Robbie's on 30 Rock, you know, and different people have embraced your music. And it seems like you've been getting closer to, you know, some sort of, you know, critical mass, in that I was really excited to see you playing with Steve Martin, and there you are on Jimmy Kimmel Show, and then your clips of you at the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, do you have that sense of, well, you know, it's like I'm an overnight success at age 62.
Oh God. No.
Not really over. I mean, I'm being ironic, but there is a sense that it's been a steadily building thing, and I think that's part of the reason you can evolve, is that there wasn't like this kind of peak that you had to live up to, and that sort of feeling of like, how do I get there again? It's like you've just been building something and it's paying off now, which is fun for fans of yours to see.
Yeah, it's too bad it's all coming to a head just as nobody's buying music anymore. But no, it's cool. Life is great. It's surprisingly, it's surprising.
You just toss that off. Life is great.
It is great.
Good.
I almost don't want to say that. I mean, you're in Chicago. I moved away from Chicago, and I love Chicago, and I'm always aware when I say something positive about Los Angeles that it, like, hits some people's ears the wrong way, maybe, like, yeah, blah, what, fucking Los Angeles, whatever. But there is something about living here, because wherever you are, it's people, right? I mean, I'm playing with people, you're meeting people, and forming relationships and sometimes friendships. And here it's like one of the guys is Steve Martin, as you said, and it's like, and that came about through a specific chain of events. But I mean, it's just, I mean, he lives here, right? Right.
What was the chain of events? You can walk us through that.
Well, it's simple. I mean, I'm with this label now, which is Compass, and it's largely a bluegrass label. I did a bluegrass record, and so now. There's a little part of my brand, I guess, which is bluegrass or bluegrass adjacent. And he does bluegrass music. And so there's a pretty small community of people. It's not like hundreds, but dozens of people that drift in and out of his orbit. You know, most notably Steep Canyon Rangers, who had a long relationship with Steve. But a lot of my friends and people that I play with have also played with him. And eventually sort of it came around to me. And one of the reasons that it did was because I'm here, you know what I mean? Like, he was working these two local gigs, and so I was here. And so
he needed a picker for that and a singer.
He was using my the lady that runs my label is called Allison Brown, and she's one of the best living Scruggs style banjoists, and he and Allison are have a mutual admiration society and work together quite a lot. And so I'm friends with Allison, and it just all worked out. But also the fact that I'm conveniently just a few miles from, you know, his house and from the Hollywood Bowl and the rest of it, I mean, it just all worked out. And so anyway, that's just to get to the point that the relationships are localized, you know. So if I lived in Seattle, I'd be playing with these people, and I live here and I get to play with certain other people. And that's, for me, that's been like just a fun point of this sort of starting over period where we just took this random kind of move late life when the kids moved out of the house. We thought, oh, where can we go? And my wife's like, well, I kind of want to go to Los Angeles and explore that, because she has an agency here. She's a voiceover actress. And it made sense for her. For me, it was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't see it as a big country music town. And indeed, I'm in a pretty narrow group of people out here that play bluegrass. But luckily, I'm interested in other things, too. And there are plenty of good players out here.
When you walk into the room for the first time to play with Steve Martin, do you have this feeling of, yeah, we're peers, this is great? Or is there also part of you that remembers, you know, seeing Let's Get Small and seeing him as Steve Martin, you know, for all those years and think, wow, this is crazy?
Yeah. My brother was like, so you were driving to Steve Martin's house? Like, you must have been going fucking crazy in your head. I said, I know what you mean. Okay, I shouldn't tell this story, only because it's the kind of story one shouldn't oneself tell. But I'm going to tell it because it just naturally is what we're talking about. But I was in my head on the drive to his house, which is where we rehearsed before the Kimmel show. I was thinking of all the things that could happen. I'm like, okay, he could say this. I won't say that in response. I'm just going to be, I'm there to do the work. I'm going to keep my head. I'm old enough not to go crazy when something happens. You know, if this had happened when I was 30, I would have gone crazy. Right? But I ran over different scenarios in my head, and I walked into his house. And so the first thing that he did, this is what I shouldn't tell. He strode across his living room with his arm outstretched, and he said, I'm a real big fan, he says. And I said, Jesus Christ, like that. I recoiled and said, Jesus Christ. So none of that went the way that I wanted it to go, because the compliment just threw me.
Did he laugh? Did he laugh at your reaction?
He did not. He did not. I had heard in advance, somebody told me, don't make a bunch of jokes when you're around him. He really doesn't appreciate that. So I did not. And I was myself, and I was just like, but I didn't talk a lot. I just focused on the work. He really, now that we're talking about it, we had one song to do on that TV show. He wanted to do it so many times that it just blew my mind. Like, we were 3 hours at his house. We probably did it 25 times, talked in between, talked about how we would stand, how this part of the song would go, or this part. But I mean, there's never really a need to do a song 25 times, in my view. You know, it's not a Gentle Giant song. It's a pretty simple song. And I think 3 of your listeners will appreciate that.
Right? I appreciated it, and I couldn't sing one Gentle Giant song for you, but I know.
They're complex.
Early 70s prog.
And that story just goes nowhere except to say it was like really, really totally out of my field of experience, this idea about just doing something. Somebody else told me, like all the people that had worked with him, like told me, oh, do this and be prepared for that. But one guy said, remember, he like got to start in magic. So that's an element of his approach to the art, is it's like there's a performed series of bodily motions to sort of internalize. And to me, that's what I observed in his approach.
Interesting. Well, and I saw some of the Hollywood Bowl thing, and he did have like a sort of a gag with you where he introduced you and then you started talking and he's like, okay, and sort of cut you. Was that like a bit that you knew was coming, or was that, did you just sort of
totally,
set that
yeah.
up?
Yeah. Like everything was worked out. There's no improvisation in the thing. And the day before, we were in a different rehearsal place, and a rehearsal was over. I was sitting in a corner, and he came over and he said, tomorrow, should I introduce you? And I said, oh, no. Same way I said, Jesus Christ. I said, no. And then I said, oh, wait a minute, but I'm singing a song. That would make sense. It would be odd for me not to be introduced, maybe. And he said, well, there's something I used to do with this other guy where I'd say this and then you'd say that. I said, like, a comic routine with you? I said, yes, I will do that. That will be a highlight of my life to do that. So yeah, it was all pretty well scripted. I think it was even, I wasn't looking, but I think it was on the teleprompter, our lines.
Really?
My line was, well, I.
Right.
And then a long M dash after the word yeah. I.
Well, it made it onto YouTube and Facebook because that was where I saw it. I just got a kick out of it, obviously.
Oh, the whole 4 days was worth it for that 3 second moment.
What was playing in that band like, by the way, and seeing him playing and just being in that? I mean, was this sort of one of the more elevated bluegrass performances you've been involved in?
Totally. And I mean, I can't speak for him. I probably shouldn't say this, but I think my point of view was like probably adjacent to his, which was like, oh, how lucky I am to be playing with these great players, you know. And for me, I have to like really try to stay on my feet just to try to keep up with these, with Allison, with Tristan Scroggins, with Christian Settlemyer, these great players, and who I also work with, you know, on my gigs a lot of the time. And that's why I like to play with them, because they just make me better. They make me try to be better. I don't know if they make me better, but I try.
We did 2 nights ago on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. It's called 5 Days Out and 2 Days Back, and it's a story of sort of life on the road for musicians, and it's going to be sung by Robbie Foulkes. Robbie is one of the great bluegrass singers. Robbie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well,
what an amazing tale of loss and redemption. Here we go.
You've always made a point of playing with different musicians. And I think touring for this record, you're playing with a lot of different musicians as well. I mean, that just, at what point did that become something where it's like, yeah, some people have their band and they play with the same three people their whole lives, but you really get something out of the interactions with so many different types of players, as well as the fact that there are so many players.
Yeah, that happened in 2009. I can name
okay.
The time when it happened. And I went from having like a steady band quartet all the time to like every run's going to be different. And it's kind of boring. There are a bunch of reasons for it. But I mean, basically the songs just always sound a little bit different to me. And there's also the pleasure of, you know, seeing somebody in an airport, picking up somebody that you haven't seen for 8 months. And but you know each other pretty well, and you're, oh, it's been going on in your life, and the drive to the gig is a lot more interesting that way when you're mixing it up with people.
So going into this album, did you have like an idea before you started writing in the desert of, you know, I want to do like a lot of different types of music with different sort of lineups and approaches, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to write the songs and then figure out how to arrange them?
Yeah, I had players in mind because on this new record, Now Then, I think 13 songs ended up on it, 12 or 13. And there's two guys on it, Duke Levine and Kevin Berry, that I had been playing with pretty occasionally for maybe 15 years, that I was a big fan of both of those guys and wanted to leverage that because... Well, I should say those two guys and Paul Bryan, who's a bass player, and Jay Bellerose, who plays the drums, came up together in Boston in the 90s and played together so often that they have one of those, you know, mental relationships that guys have when they spent a lot of young years together. And so those four people played together on several of the songs on the record. There's a little churn between the players, but those four people brought a relationship into the record that I just like rode on top of, like we were just talking about with Steve Martin and those guys. Like I was riding on top of this beautiful wave. So I had that in mind, and I also had I also had Pete Thomas in mind. Pete's a drummer that has worked a long time with Elvis Costello and the Attractions, as you well know.
He's one of my favorite drummers.
Yeah, he's great.
I saw his name on there. I was like, whoa. And he also does great drumming for Los Lobos. I think it's sort of under the radar a little bit that he's the main drummer on Kiko.
Kiko.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the few after that, too.
Incredible resume. And he's turned himself into a really heavy session, you know, studio guy since he's moved to L.A., which I think has been over 20 years now. So Pete and I became friends not long after I moved here. And that was thrilling for me. And musically, we'd done just a little bit. I think we did an internet show, and we did I sat in with his band in a club, and we did one studio thing together. But anyway, I was so excited by that sound, and this new relationship. That when I was writing this, I thought, wow, what's a way to like besides just being excited by the thought of the drumming and thinking about the sound, what's a sort of purposeful way to use that? I wrote this song that starts with me in New York as a young man, and the reason that I did and the reason I used him on the song, is that. Drumming, that time feel is sort of the soundtrack, as I imagine it, of my years when I was 17, 18, 19.
Is that now?
Right.
That was my assumption that was the one he played on. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's just about the story. I mean, it's about being young and the feel of it. And he's playing on it, and he does an actual quote from Armed Forces somewhere on it that I'll let your listeners like try to find. Because it's a fun game. And then there's a part in the middle that's meant to evoke blood and chocolate in the mix. So there's all these little touches that are like musical winks, but they're also like personally, you know, meaningful for me.
So when you wrote that song, you had him in mind already? Or
right.
As you wrote it, you thought, so he was right there, like, I'm going to write this rocker and Pete's going to play the drums on it. And I just got to tell the story I want to tell.
Right.
That's interesting. I remember at some point, you know, one of these things, if you were starting a band with a drummer, who would it be? I'm like, Pete Thomas, you know, he just kind of plays
everything. What's interesting about Pete that I didn't know was before he was playing with Elvis Costello, he was playing with John Stewart. Did you know this?
No.
Like John was his first gig, I think, and he did it for 2, maybe 3 years when he was real young. So it was a long, pretty long stretch. And to go from John Stewart to Elvis Costello strikes me as such. I was talking to him about it once, and I said, you know, when I was when it was the 70s and I was getting into Elvis Costello and you guys, I thought, oh, now I've got to drop all my John Stewart affiliations, because this is like at odds with that. It's the now thing, and it's credible among my generation in a way that this older stuff isn't. He said, well, that's kind of stupid. I said, well, I agree. Now that I'm older, I agree that's stupid. You can like different kinds of things. But yeah, it's interesting to think of him playing, like so for your listeners who don't know, like John Stewart was in the Kingston Trio.
Right.
And, you know, had a separate career as a solo act afterwards.
He had that hit Gold in the late 70s. I think, did Lindsey Buckingham produce it? Yeah, I remember there's like a Fleetwood Mac, you know, or they backed him on it or something.
Right. And Pete told a amusing story about one day we went over to Nick Reynolds's house. And Nick Reynolds was the short guy in the Kingston Trio who played conga drum and tenor guitar and jumped around. So they went over to this other guy from the Kingston Trio's house near San Diego, and Pete says, it was full on mighty wind.
My second guest on Carol Pop, it went Richard Thompson and then Bruce Thomas. And he also was like in some, you know, not new wavy punk bands in the early 70s, and they would play soccer with Pink Floyd and I think he was the one who told me the story about how when he went to interview for the Attractions, he had to like not tell Elvis that he really loved Steely Dan, because that would have been, he was afraid that would have been a disqualifying point if he actually mentioned how much he loved Steely Dan.
It's the same story, isn't it? You can't like both.
They all loved Steely Dan, though. You don't, yeah. But I could tell from your face. Listeners can't see the face, the sort of subtly pained face you made when I said Steely Dan.
I don't know. It's just such a deeply ingrained instinct that you like this, you don't like that. But Steely Dan's one of those things, like I'm trying to reevaluate my biases, you know, in my older age. And so not long ago, I listened to two or three of their records. I listened to two or three Eagles records. I went for all these things that I just knew that I didn't like. And they're fine. They're fine.
It does seem like you moving out to LA was a pretty significant move for you artistically as well as personally. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like it just kind of jump-started something else?
I feel like, how could it not have been? Like, no matter where I moved, it would have, like, nudged me in a new direction, probably, you know, whether it was the North Pole or here or wherever. But, I mean, I think you're talking about more like in a publicity way or more in a...
No. I'm thinking in terms of like being surrounded by, like you were saying, you're just surrounded by musicians and inspired by a whole new group of people, and just the air and the atmosphere are different, and just a change of scenery. I just would think that, like, in terms of creatively and stuff you've done, that would sort of be some sort of boost or change or something.
Yeah, honestly, it's inculcated a humility. Like, I thought I was humble before I came here, but I wasn't as humble as I thought. And so being in a place where I didn't hardly know anybody, like, I've had to, like, I go to these sessions with guys. I was at one last night, and I try to be, I don't know if humble is the right way. I mean, you just have to meet people. I have to start over again in a way. I have to make friends. I have to meet musicians. And to do that, you have to make yourself, you know, not a dick. And like, I wasn't really a dick, but I was just I deflate myself. I go into these things. I meet people, but I'm also confident because I'm an old guy. Like, I have a skill set to offer. So it's kind of a perfect position to be in. This is kind of a funny thing. I'll try to tell the story quickly and without using people's names, because it reflects in a weird way on old age. But I was at the session last night, and there's like 10 or 12 people there. And we're all old. Like, the theme of this session, there's different jamming dynamics or cultures, and this one is old is the theme. Like, I'm probably the youngest.
So this is a recording session for some album or something?
No, it's just a jam session. Meeting up, yeah.
Okay.
Playing songs, and you sit in a circle, and a guy goes, "Let's do this," and everybody joins in, and it just goes around. It's like something that, so I do this a lot out here now, and I haven't done it since I was like 16 or something. You know, I didn't do it back home in Chicago, but I'm doing it now partly for practical reasons. Like I say, I want to meet people, but it's partly been like a helpful character formation. Like, you know, this idea about just playing music, we're not doing it for any practical reason. We're doing it for joy, share stories, share songs. It's just like, it's that. It's kind of spiritual. But anyway, one person goes, she says, "Well, I brought this song of mine that I was hoping to do." And she handed out a piece of paper. She said, "Here are the chords." And we looked at the paper and I was like, "No, these aren't the chords. These are the lyrics. Like, but you want to sing something? Well, guess what the chords might be." And she sang a little bit, and we couldn't guess what the chords were. And then somebody said, "Well, let's listen to the record." Because she had made a record of it, you know, this is a pretty famous person. So somebody got out their iPhone and pulled it up, and then they go, "How do you turn up these things so you can hear?" And then somebody else goes, "Hit the little button on the side." So somebody like hits the button on the side, and then somebody, "I still can't hear the bass." Somebody else goes, like I said, like, "Put it in a cup," and there's no cup. And then the piano player took it, and he starts, does somebody have a pencil? And then somebody brings over a pencil. He starts trying to write down the chords, and he's trying to hear them. And then he's listening to the song. He says, "Wait a minute." He says, "I played on this session. I'm on this song," he says.
Wow.
This is like blowing my mind. And all this happens like 20 minutes and then it ends with nothing because we can't figure out the chords and we couldn't play the song and we had to move on. It was so fucking hilarious. And that's what it's been like out here.
So are you in someone's living room or are you actually in a club or like what's, is there an audience for this or is it just you guys?
It's a unique and a weird place that I also can't describe because that would like give away the personalities involved. But it's kind of like a, it's kind of like a workspace out 12 miles from town. It's a weird place where we gather and it's just old people doing their thing. It's, I love it. I always look forward to it. It's like every other week I do that one. And then every other week there's another one in this engineer's backyard over yonder. So that's what it's like. And like I say, it's like, it's so different than in Chicago. Part of it's the weather because there's warm weather backyard things going on like a lot of the year here.
Right. I think people in Chicago, I mean, as someone who's still here and has been tempted when I, especially when I was covering, you know, the entertainment business for the Tribune, but did not move out to the LA Bureau at that time. You know, we have this sort of sense of, oh, you know, they're great players here and, you know, great theater and great art and all this, all of which is true. And so there's kind of this defensiveness of almost like, oh, you know, if you go to LA, it's, you know, I don't know, you're leaving Chicago. But like, A, my sense is that people in LA appreciate people from Chicago because as the cliche goes, we work hard and we're creative and that sort of thing. But when I, whenever I'm in LA, you know, if even if it's just for several days, you know, just the people who I can see, who I know from having covered, you know, film stuff or music stuff or whatever, I mean, they're just out there. And it is easier if you can go to, you know, a living room or someone's house or a workspace and collaborate with them, then you do it here. And obviously it's going to be different. And, you know, there's a reason people move there.
Yeah. I mean, I find it pretty relaxed socially, but I mean, there's so many factors in this. Like I was young when I came to Chicago and I was more like, you know, anxious to prove myself and not that anxious anymore. And then there's the weather, and then there's the fact that the recording industry is here. I mean, there's a lot, there's just a lot that, for me anyway, like, disincentivizes me to like, you know, say I got to establish my place in the dominance hierarchy out here. And like I say, it's age and it's a lot of relaxing factors. But it's funny that to try to do that in Chicago I found always a little bit absurd. You know, the dominance hierarchy is just like, what is the dominance hierarchy in Chicago? It's like, you know, I got a record deal. In the 80s, I played at Batteries Not Included. I mean, what are you bragging about out there? Like nobody should be boasting anyway, but the, let's leave it at that. Nobody should be fucking boasting. I hate
that. There you go. LA, it's nice. I mean, there are just like a lot of working musicians out there and working artists. And, you know, people are just trying to make a living. It's not just everyone's getting rich and getting their big deals and stuff. I think a lot of, it's interesting because a lot of the people I've talked to, you know, like you talk to someone from the Go-Go's or the Bangles or something, there's always kind of this peak and then sort of the weird record company stuff. And you know, there are kind of these arcs that so many of these artists went through. But for the most part, people just sort of settle into, I'm making music because that's what I love to do. And you can do that in LA, you can do it in Chicago, New York, wherever.
Yeah, no, agreed.
Do you know a lot more music now than you did, say, 26 years ago?
I think
because when I got to know you, I thought of you as someone who was very rooted in like pre-Beatles roots, rockabilly country stuff. And now I think of you as being a little, you know, now you're dropping Gentle Giant references. I'll just put it that way.
Well, like Gentle Giant, I only know because there was a drummer that I used to travel around with, Dan Massey, who played that stuff at least once. And that's how a lot of stuff gets on my radar is like musicians that I work with, which has been great. So I've definitely expanded my base in that way. Like I'm familiar with, I mean, just the fact that there are all these languages out there, so to speak, in these styles. And the fact that no one style is just inherently the style, which is a heresy that I would have bought into, you know, when I was younger, when I was a teenager or whatever. That's been very educational. But in terms of actual like song lyrics and chord progressions in my head, I think it's, I think I'm probably losing it as I age. I think I've got less memorized than I used to.
But did you get like more exposed to, say, Brian Wilson over the years, Beach Boys, that sort of thing? Because I don't think you knew God Only Knows when we were talking 26 years ago.
Oh, there's so much that I don't know. And for whatever reason, I mean, this is another thing I was talking about with Pete Thomas the other day, was like this guy, Nick Drake. I just read this book by Joe Boyd, who produced Nick Drake. And
right.
They just put out that
album of like four records of Nick Drake demos for this first album.
I think that's what Pete was talking about, because he said to listen to it, it's like of a piece with a lot of different, with a lot of other acts you can name, but there's something that's hard to identify about it that raises it a level above those other acts. And like, I get that concept and I hear that music and I can hear the quality in it. I can hear it's good, but I can't make an attachment with it for whatever reason, just because I'm coming to it too late. You know, and Brian Wilson's just another thing. It's got nothing to do with the music. It's like, I just, for whatever reason, I was just on a different wavelength and not listening right to Beach Boys when I was 15, 20, 30 years old. It was just all going past me. And so like, I listened to a Beach Boys record the other day. It's another thing where I thought I gotta get into some relationship with this great thing that it was about, but couldn't quite make it. You know what I could get a relationship with from that same Joe Boyd book was Millie Small. I don't know if you remember Millie. She's this Jamaican singer from the early 60s, and her big hit was a remake of a song by, I think Barbie Gay is the name, and Barbie's version of My Boy Lollipop was in the mid-50s, and Millie's was...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he talks about that.
Yeah, Lollipop.
Right. The Jamaican... It basically launched... Did it launch Studio One or Trojan? Or it was like the first kind of crossover reggae hit, I think.
And it launched a studio in London, you're saying?
I think it launched one of those Jamaican studios, but... or maybe it was when Joe Boyd was on Island. Maybe it launched Island Records, like their sort of reggae.
Yeah, so Chris Blackwell, like
pre-reggae, really. I shouldn't call it reggae.
Right, ska more. Yeah, the success of it, like he could tell in advance, according to the Joe Boyd book, which is a great book called "And the Roots of Rhythm Remain." But
yep.
Yeah, Chris Blackwell, and it's a fucking long book too.
It's a phone book with a hardcover. I had him on. We talked about that book. I've had him on twice. I had him on early and we did like a two-parter because we talked for like over 2 hours. And it was kind of like the first part was him in London, like discovering, you know, Pink Floyd and Fairport Convention and running the UFO Club, which I always thought was UFO, but it's UFO. And then the second part was the stuff in the 70s. Did you know that he produced Dueling Banjos? Like he was working for Warner Brothers Records, and he's working for Warner Brothers Studio, the film studio, and one of his projects was Deliverance, and he's the one who got those players together to do Dueling Banjos. That was like his.
Imagine writing a 1,000-page book about your life, and that doesn't even come.
That was in the first book. It probably wasn't in the first book because My White Bicycles I think only goes up through the 60s. So. Yeah, he did that. He also is the one who produced Amazing Grace, that Aretha Franklin, the gospel film, and it came out as an album in the early 70s, but the film didn't come out until, about 5 years ago or something. But he was a producer. That was like his project at Warner Brothers. He's like a little bit of everything.
So much knowledge in that head, and I'm going to listen to those shows as soon as we get done with this.
Now you got to track down My White Bicycles, his first book, which is much shorter, but it's all swinging London and him being, you know, the American who moves to London and all of his experiences there. And it's like incredible string band who I don't know that well. And then like Pink Floyd and, you know, the Move would play there, but he produced like Fairport Convention, basically discovered them. It's a good book.
Yeah, I should look up that book. I got to say that one of the things that hooked me into And the Roots of Rhythm Remain was like, it starts out with an anecdote or close to the top about him trying to produce this session, which combines New Orleans percussionist,
right,
what, Haitian or Cuban or some island?
I think it was Cuban. I think it was Cuban in New Orleans.
And they couldn't get it together, and they couldn't make it happen. And that made him wonder when he was a young man, like, why are beats felt differently, you know, between one culture and another? And at the top of the book, I'm like, I am in so hard to this book now, because I wonder that too. I want to learn about that aspect of music, you know.
Are there types of music that you haven't recorded that you think you would love to explore, like to do like your New Orleans, you know, funk record or something?
Well, stuff just swims across your radar, to mix metaphors. And like in the exact case of that book, like I've been listening to a lot of Cuban music lately, and then somebody came up with like a Gordon Lightfoot tribute record. So I immediately thought, I'm going to do like a Cuban percussion take on a Gordon Lightfoot song, because he's a Canadian guy. His music is really completely pretty great, you know, the best part of it, in my opinion. But the one thing that you could bring to it that would be fresh and, you know, kind of absent in the original is like a really groovy percussion bass. Despite the fact that Jim Gordon plays on some of the music, and, you know, there's great percussionists here and there. But anyway, that's just an example. Like, you know, this thing's in my head because I'm reading this book, and then somebody asks you to do a recording, and you think, well, who lives here in town that does it? That's how this stuff comes up, which is kind of organically. So it's not really designed, so to speak. You know, I got to get this on my plate next, and I got to try to do this. It just kind of comes up.
You just have more possibilities out there.
Yeah, I don't even mean out here. I mean just like what gives me the idea of like trying to take on a certain style. But also as I get older, I'm like, you know, I don't have infinite capacity for like being the voice of anything that I want to be the voice of. Just because I like a certain kind of music doesn't mean that I can represent it.
Did you go into this album thinking the first line is going to be, it's time to make a change?
No. I knew that was going to be the first song after I wrote it, but I don't think that I wrote that. I think I wrote that song later on in that period of writing all those songs. And that song came up, like something bad happened to me. And it put me in a mood that I've almost never been in. Like I was in a negative and emotional and kind of I was kind of in a desperate mood, and I just started writing this song, and so driven by this negative emotion, I wrote this song. But once I had written it, kind of liked it, and I'm like, I think this has gone on the record because it's got a unique flavor to it. You know, I've never really done anything like that, and the fact that the first line is spoken and not sung. And it doesn't have instruments or anything. It's just like a guy talking.
Right.
Yeah, this is a good opening, you know. You just hear
it starts off so spare, and then all those harmonies come in too, which is like kind of a nice moment where it sort of opens up the record like, oh, okay, this is going to be a Technicolor record and not a black and white record.
I'm glad you thought that. Yeah, I just love the way it came out. I mean, it sounds egoistic, but it's not, because I love the way that Kimon Kirk did those voices that you're talking about, and Duke and Kevin played it. And as it goes on, it's like a 3-minute song called Working No More. And it starts with just the voice. And then 30 seconds later, it's something different. And 20 seconds after that, it's something different yet. It just keeps kind of like growing as it goes
right
along.
They say, I've lost the thread. I'm too old. You were in a mood when you wrote that.
Yeah, I was in a bad mood.
Because who's they? Who is they? Who says you've lost the thread?
I can't say. There's so many things I can't say in this interview. That's another sign of age. I'm like protecting other people more.
Yeah, whose song was it? Who was the woman who like handed over, said here's the chords, and it was just the lyrics, then you had to pull up her record. Who was that? Come on. The 30-year marriage, is that what it seems to be? Is that just your, you know, you reflecting on your life with Donna?
Did you say 30 or 40?
The 30-year marriage.
Oh, 30, yeah.
You could do it. You could do another one in 10 years.
Yeah, there's so much you can do when you're losing your hearing.
We didn't fall out of love, we fell into rhythm. That's a nice line.
I liked it too.
Is that one where you wrote it and then you said, hey, Donna, listen to this. I just wrote the song.
I wrote everything past her. I mean, once I'd written all of the songs for the record, I just sat her down and played all 13 of them or whatever. And she said yes to all of them, which she rarely does. I mean, that's an unusual success rate for me. But generally, when she says thumbs down, then I just toss it.
But like that one specifically is referring to the two of you. If you look at like songs being autobiographical as opposed to they're about these characters who've been married for 30 years, you know, I love the idea of like the couples and you saying, look at us, we're what you hope for. This is your best case scenario right here. Look at us.
Right. Which in the song, I think, I mean, people can take it however they want. I think the mood of that statement is, yeah, it's a little bit cynical. Like, look at us aged, old people. This is the best case scenario.
You right.
know, you're gonna stay together, but you're going to fall apart and get old. And
it's a little bit of a taunt to the young people, but it's also a triumphant thing.
But it's also
sort of
a follow-up to their earlier observation. The couple is like in a vacation spot where the younger couples don't want to look at them, which is something that happens when you get older. Like people, like you're at a party and like, just shut up, old guy. Like, let us young people continue our conversation. Just like get to the end of your sentence and don't talk for a while. How about? Sometimes people would rather you were invisible or gone. And from what I read from older writers, that's truer the older you get anyway. And that song, like the younger people don't want to look at them. And at the end of it, the guy's saying, look at us, just look at us. So that's part of it too. But Donna gets it, you know, she gets, like we were saying about Ocean City, like she gets it. It's a mixture of imagination and invention and real life. And that's just, it's kind of what I'm doing now. Like it's, they're all like, I don't know, 70% actual, I think, these songs.
Pretty high percentage.
Yeah, I think so.
It's Porn Sharp-Witted, that was a funny one.
Yeah, that's the only one that's like almost 0% true.
Well, except nothing in the world gets you fired up quite like getting out of where you're getting out of where you're from. That's
right,
the true part.
It was good to get off the farm for sure.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you so much. That's all for episode 193 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Robbie Faulks for continuing our ongoing conversation with him and letting us live vicariously through his excellent musical adventures. His new album, Now Then, is out now on Compass Records. You can buy it through Robbie's website, robbiefaulks.com, at robbiefaulks.bandcamp.com, and wherever else quality music is sold. Robbie is currently on tour. The show's in Wayne and State College, Pennsylvania on September 11th and 12th, and upcoming dates in Columbia, Maryland, Vienna, Virginia, a couple towns in California, and in October, Evanston, Illinois, Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and more. Go to robbiefaulks.com for more information and to buy tickets. Follow his Facebook page, too. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who has hung out with his share of Roots Rock weirdos. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks. Thanks.